Today on Against the Grain, COVID has laid bare the inequities of our society and the dysfunction of our medical system, which focuses at great cost on disease treatment rather than fostering health. So contends epidemiologist Sandro Galea. He argues that the pandemic provides an opening to rethink medicine along with housing, wages, and racial and social inequality, and to treat health as a public good. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. As the world waits to find out whether the new Omicron variant is more contagious or deadly, what lies at the root of Americans' particular vulnerability to COVID? Sandro Galea argues in The Contagion Next Time, out from Oxford University Press, that the state and medical sector do not treat health as a public good, which is reinforced by, and reinforces, deep social inequalities. Galea is the dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. I had a chance to speak with him before the announcement last week of the Omicron variant. The course that COVID has taken has been really stark, with millions of deaths around the world. Yet you point out that things could have been worse had it been a different virus, such as SARS, which broke out in 2003. Can you tell us how and why you think that in some sense we have sidestepped something potentially more deadly?
We tend to think that what happens to us is what was always going to happen to us, but we forget that really we were lucky in other cases. SARS is a good example. So SARS hit North America. It hit Toronto, Canada. There were deaths there, and it really affected the health system quite a bit. But it never really came to the United States. And I think we tend to forget that, and we think, well, just SARS was not an issue for us. Well, it was not an issue because we got lucky. Now, SARS had a higher case fatality rate than COVID by quite a bit, probably about 10% versus about 1%. So, and the argument that I make in the book is there's no reason to believe that we will not have a pandemic with a pathogen, with a virus that is not more lethal than COVID. COVID was a very transmissible virus, but the lethality at the end of the day is probably not that high. But there are viruses like SARS, viruses like MERS, which have much higher mortality rate. And of course, there will be other viruses that we have not even heard of yet so far. So to my mind, as we think about the next pandemic, we need to always bear in mind that it's entirely plausible that we will have a virus that has a higher case fatality rate that actually poses more problems than this one has.
You argue that the state of public health has everything to do with how the degree to which Americans have suffered from COVID. And we're going to talk a fair amount about that in the course of this hour. But I wonder if you could give us a sense of the state of public health in the United States before COVID arrived.
So we have a odd set of circumstances in this country when it comes to the state of the health of the public. And I'm using the health of the public intentionally because when I talk about public health, I want to talk about public health infrastructure. So let's just talk about the health of the population. So we as a country spend more on health than does any other country in the world by quite a bit, by about 30 to 40% more. Despite that, we live sicker and shorter lives than does anybody else in other high-income countries. So we live less by about 5 years. Our life expectancy is about 5 years less than comparable high-income countries. And we have more disease during that time. We have more hypertension, more diabetes, more obesity. So it's a funny state of affairs where we spend more but get less. And one would argue that there is no other sector where we are willing to tolerate spending more and getting less, but we do tolerate this in health. So the short answer to the question is, what is the state of the health of the public? Is it's not very good. And of course, the longer question is, why is that?
Well, let's talk about that then. What do you see as the origins, and you argue that in many ways they're multiple, of the sad state of public health in the United States?
The origins of the sad state, which is it's a good expression, of the sad state of public health in the United States are at core that we do not have a good understanding of what it is that causes health, that generates health. We have for a long time had a notion that health is due to our doctors and to our medicines. But of course, doctors and medicines and nurses are not about health. They are about treating us when we are sick. Ultimately, health is about the world we live in. It's about the conditions of the world around us. It's about safe housing, good schools, livable wages, gender equity, clean air, drinkable water, a fair economy. These are the conditions that create the world where we live, work, and play. And those are the conditions that generate health. Ultimately, we want to optimize those conditions so we can be as healthy as possible for as long as possible and minimize our use of doctors, nurses, and medicines. Now, we want to have excellent medical care system. We want to have excellent clinical care because when we are sick, we want to be looked after and restored to health. But I think we can all agree that we would rather just be healthy and avoid going to the doctor to begin with.
I'd like to ask you about some particulars of that ill health. You write in the book about mental health, which, as you have yourself studied, has become increasingly worse during COVID. But even preceding COVID, how would you describe the state of mental health, and how would you understand it as embedded in all those forces that you mentioned that are really social, that go well beyond the narrowly medical?
So we have had a much greater awareness of mental health and mental health challenges in this country in the past decade than really we've ever had, which I think is all to the good. Mental health has long gone on as an under-recognized component of health, despite the fact that we know that mental health and physical health go hand in hand. In fact, you cannot have one without the other. We know, for example, that probably only a third of people who could benefit from mental health services actually get mental health services. And we know that mental health is enormously responsive to social and economic conditions. So in COVID, as you alluded to, we showed, and other people have shown as well, that mood and anxiety disorders, things like depression or anxiety, rose about threefold in a time of COVID and stayed up. They stayed up for throughout 2020 into 2021, which is a really long time to have such an elevation in any disorder, and particularly something like mood anxiety disorders. So our conceptual shift that we need to make is to recognize that mental health is inextricable from health. It is a core part of health as much as is physical health. And we should look at it the way we look at, for example, broken bones. We, you know, I mentioned that only about a third of Americans get care they could benefit from for mental illness. If I were to tell you that only about a third of Americans got their broken bones looked after, we would consider that a national disgrace. But it, and we should similarly think of it for mental health.
Another thing that you write about in thinking about this period of American public health is the opioid crisis, which obviously preceded COVID and was intensified during COVID. Can you tell us about how we should understand that crisis within the larger framework that you're advocating?
The opioid crisis has been with us for 20 years, grumbling forward and with more and more opioid deaths. We saw a peak of opioid deaths 2 years ago, and then we were beginning to see a downturn in these deaths from opioids until 2020. 2020, we had 93,000 opioid deaths, which was 20% more than we had had in 2019. And of course, that's tragic. The reasons for that are many, but a lot of them are linked to COVID. They are linked to the fact that we had people locked down, people inside, a lot of more depression, a lot more anxiety, and which that we know goes hand in hand with more use of drugs, and resulting then in accidental opioid overdoses. So one of the things that's been happening in a time of COVID is that we are seeing more cases of disease from all sorts of other conditions, and opioid deaths being one of them. And in many respects, we have not discussed this anywhere near enough in the public conversation and the media, that we have been focused so singularly on COVID that we are forgetting that other diseases are also affecting us. People are sick with other things. People are dying from other things, and at higher rates than we did before COVID, in no small part because we have not been tending to them.
And are these being tracked in the same way as they would have been before COVID? Of course, these were in the early days when before vaccines that people were not going to see the doctor, obviously because of fear of picking up COVID. And so there was an increase in heart attacks and all sorts of other deaths because people weren't seeking treatment. Do we know if that's continued, and what are the challenges of actually tracking the data on such deaths or illnesses?
We do have the data on these, and we do know that it has continued. The excess mortality, which is a term that is used for deaths over baseline, has really been extraordinary through 2020 and now tracking into 2021 from all sorts of illnesses, from Alzheimer's, from strokes, from heart disease, in no small part because we people have been forsaking routine care, because people have been in isolation and doing things that they otherwise would not have done. And I think we're at a point in the history of COVID where we need to really, really start paying attention to the breadth of conditions that cause our health, that really move beyond thinking of COVID as an exceptional disease and starting to reckon with COVID as one of many other diseases that kill people. You know, COVID in 2020 became the third leading cause of death in the United States, which is extraordinary when you think about it for a disease that we had never heard of, right? We had never heard of COVID in 2019. 2020 becomes third leading cause of death. And I was explaining this to a group recently, and somebody said to me, "Oh, wow, that's amazing." And I said, "Yeah, it is incredible." But I said, no, what's amazing is that you're saying it's the third leading cause of death, that heart disease and cancer killed more people than COVID, because I thought, given how much we talked about COVID, that COVID would be the most important cause of that. And I realized then that the public conversation has so been weighted in the direction of COVID that we have collectively forgotten that, yes, many more people die from heart disease, many people die from cancer. And, you know, COVID has been a tragedy. I mean, in 2020 alone, there were about 500,000 Americans who died from COVID. But those 500,000 Americans are on a backdrop of about 3.4 million other Americans who die from other things. And we cannot forget that. And I worry sometimes when I talk like this that people say, "I'm downplaying COVID." Not at all, not for a moment. I think COVID truly has been a tragedy. It has affected people's lives in ways that are unimaginably sad. But at the same time, it is also part of a broader spectrum of diseases that affect people's lives and that we should be paying attention to.
Right. And as you're arguing, since those other diseases often have been affected, intensified by the circumstances that COVID wrought, and mental health being just one part of it, and given that it seems a consensus is forming that the pandemic is going to continue on in some form for a while, do you feel like at this point you can make an assessment about the state of health for Americans? I mean, is this kind of a high watermark at this point?
To my mind, we're at a phase where we need to start thinking about how we're going to be living with COVID. It's very clear COVID is not going to go away. It will move from becoming pandemic to becoming endemic, which means it will have some sort of baseline rate that we're used to. And the question for us is, how do we live with it? How do we learn to live with it and move on with the next normal phase where we drop some of the more challenging social constraints that we have imposed to protect ourselves from COVID, where we become accustomed to some sort of regular booster, and where we start seeing COVID as part of a spectrum of diseases that affect our health at any given moment in time. Take the opioid crisis that we talked about a few minutes ago. It is really shocking how many more opioid deaths there were in 2020, and that's directly linked to efforts to mitigate COVID. Well, we should be making sure that we're thinking about how we can keep COVID under control without incurring more opioid deaths. And it's that kind of balance that we need to make. And the only way to do that is by thinking of COVID as part of the background of diseases that affect us, that we keep in check, while also, of course, preserving people's autonomy to live life the way they want and protecting us and each other from excess deaths from other diseases.
Epidemiologist Sandro Galea is my guest. We're discussing his book, The Contagion, next time. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So we'll return to our present period, but I wanted to ask you to give us sort of the longer view, because The picture that you're painting of the present is one that is of enormous inequalities in health outcomes, in people's lives. And yet you also argue that what makes things in some sense more bittersweet in the present is that there has been a real improvement from, say, 100 years ago, 120 years ago, and that those changes had more to do with seeing health as a public good than a medical approach. So I wonder if you could give us that comparison of what life was like in, you know, 120 years ago, and what created the kind of improvement in lifespan that we have seen, at least up to the recent present.
Yeah, there is no question that we are living at the best moment in history for health. Now, I realize that may sound like a contradiction with some of our other conversation, but I think, as you say, one needs to take the long view. For most of human history, and this is hundreds of thousands of years, human species could expect to live till about age 40 at most. In about the early 19th century, so the early 1800s, by around 1850, we started seeing an upswing in that, where we moved from a life expectancy of 40 to today, where in high-income countries, life expectancy gets close to 80. So we doubled the amount of time that we as humans could expect, reasonably expect to live in just 150 years. This is 150 years on the backdrop of hundreds of thousands of years, which is extraordinary when you think about it. So the question is, how did we do that? Well, we did that through cleaning up our cities, through making sure that we had clean air, safe water, nutritious food, through reducing violence, through making sure that we were not subject to dying from unnecessary accidents, to improving workplace conditions, through making sure that we had safe, affordable housing. It's through all of these measures that created a world around us that generated health that we achieved this incredible, incredible increase in life expectancy. Medicine treatments were a very small part of it. The biggest part of it was creating a world that generated health rather than a world that threatened us at every way. So when one recognizes that, it sets a backdrop for how one thinks about how we've done during COVID and for what we may do to improve our health going forward. What it says during COVID is that a lot of what happened during COVID was because of the world around us, because of the conditions of the world around us. And if we are to mitigate the next pandemic, those are the same conditions that we should pay attention to.
Well, then take us up to recent decades and what changed in terms of public health and attempts to change the quality of life, the places people live in, the places they work, how they work, etc., and the effects of those things on people's health.
So there has been a change in our collective reckoning with health over the past 40, 50 years. We had a shift away from seeing health as a public good to seeing health as something that we can buy and sell. And that resulted in an overwhelming investment in doctors and medicine. But the misconception is that health is something that can be bought and sold, but what we actually can buy is healthcare. And healthcare can only help us after we become sick. We shifted away from thinking of health as a state of not being sick to begin with, and from being something that is our collective responsibility to something that rests with us as individuals. And of course, that conception then elides efforts to improve the very things that I talked about, safe housing, good schools, livable wages, clean air, that we need to generate health. And that shift happened in the past 40 years, and it's been clearly detrimental to our health as a country.
So you're saying that along with a shift in orientation toward having medicine be the way that you create health, there also was disinvestment in these things like environmental protection. Can you give us some examples in the way you see those things as having demonstrable effects on the health of people?
Yeah, well, the environmental protections is an obvious one, because air pollution, we know, kills about 7 million people globally, for example. And we're much better in terms of cleaner air. That's an area where we have improved quite a bit. Take an example, housing. Take safe, affordable housing. We know that not having safe, affordable housing is associated with poor health on multiple dimensions, mental health, physical health. And one can extend that very easily, for example, to COVID. Your risk of getting COVID was increased if you had housing conditions where you were in overcrowded housing and around others from whom you could not protect yourself if they had COVID. And we saw clear patterns that people in low-wage jobs who are living in worse housing, more overcrowded housing, were then more likely to have COVID and have severe COVID. So something as basic as housing, as the quality of available housing, was directly linked to greater risk of COVID and greater risk of death from COVID.
Well, and then that leads me to the question, which there has been some attention to, but needs to be asked, which is, while we talk about COVID as something that affects us globally or nationally, it has affected some populations much more than others. Can you tell us about that?
So COVID has been experienced deeply unevenly. It's been experienced unevenly all over the world and experienced unevenly in this country. Just focusing on this country, groups of people who have lower wages, have fewer assets, have been disproportionately affected by COVID. A lot of that overlaps with racial groups in this country. Black Americans, Indigenous Americans, Latinx Americans, to a lesser extent, have borne the brunt of COVID and have been disproportionately affected. And if we were just to focus on one group by way of example, so let's focus on Black Americans by way of example. Black Americans were 2 times more likely to die from COVID during this pandemic than were white Americans. And then the question becomes, why? Why is that? Well, there are two reasons for that. Number one is greater exposure, in that Black Americans are disproportionately in lower wage jobs and in occupations which are essential work, where one does not have the luxury of working from home. So when COVID hits, then you have Black Americans being disproportionately exposed to COVID and being at greater risk of getting COVID. Secondly, we've known right from the beginning of this pandemic that it's people with underlying conditions like diabetes, hypertension, lung disease, heart disease, who are more likely to die from COVID. Well, Black Americans who have had centuries of marginalization and disadvantage, less opportunity to accumulate resources to protect themselves from these diseases, have higher burden of hypertension, lung disease, heart disease than do white Americans. As a result, they were more likely to then die from COVID than were white Americans. So it is the combination of economic structure and social circumstance coupled with history, historical disadvantage, and historical burden of poor health that then contribute to a simple data point like Black Americans are twice as likely to die from COVID than white Americans. So COVID really became a mirror to our society, really showed us problems that were there before. These were long-standing issues, and COVID elevated them and made them, to my mind, impossible to ignore.
And of course, another thing that became impossible to ignore was that in the midst of the pandemic, after a policeman killed George Floyd, there were the biggest protests in U.S. history across the country. How do you see the issue that brought into the spotlight? How do you see its connection to these larger questions of public health and inequality?
Yeah, the civil unrest that emerged after the George Floyd and the killing of other unarmed Black men and women were numerically, I think, the largest civil protest we've ever had as a country, even larger than 1968. And of course, the catalyzing factor were these shooting of unarmed Black men and women. But it wasn't just that, right? It really was a recognition of the injustice that underlies this inequity in health that was becoming manifest through COVID. I mean, this came at a time when we were starting to see and starting to discuss in mainstream media, in daily conversation, the underlying structural inequities that resulted in racial differences in health more than we ever had before. And it became, to my mind, it got to a point where it became impossible to say things like COVID does not discriminate. Well, of course, COVID was discriminating insofar as different racial groups were suffering from COVID more than others. And I think it became so clear to everybody how unjust that was, how this was a virus that was affecting us all, but we were not all experiencing it the same way. So I thought the civil unrest of 2020 was and should be a real turning point for us as a country, and that we should be taking that and learning from it and saying, how do we learn from that so that we change the conditions that resulted in so much legitimate anger and so much, in really so much pain when we recognize the inequities that shape the very foundations of how we live every day.
I'd like to ask you about Indigenous people who also disproportionately suffered from COVID. Can you talk about their circumstances, which I think have had less attention, and the ways that certain communities dealt with their particular challenges?
Yeah, Indigenous groups, as I mentioned earlier, also have experienced COVID at a much higher rate than did white Americans. And Indigenous Americans are a perfect example, perfect is the wrong word here, of long-standing marginalization and disadvantage over the course of centuries. I suppose the lesson that emerges as we talk like this is how this historical disadvantage becomes written into the health of people in the present. And the way, just to operationalize that, if you have been historically excluded from, let's say, the ability to get a mortgage and to buy a house, that means your grandparents did not buy a house when other grandparents would have, which means that the family has less wealth to pass on, which means that you have less access to resources like wealth to buffer you from hard times, which means that you are in a job which you cannot afford not to be in, which means that you are then going to be exposed to COVID at a time when others might have left their job to protect themselves from COVID, which means you're going to be more likely to have COVID. So history writes itself in our health across generations, and COVID just illustrated that in a brutal way.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Sandro Galea. He's the author of The Contagion Next Time, published by Oxford University Press. You can find a link to that at againstthegrain.org. He's dean of the Boston University School of Public Health and also the author of the book Well. You described a situation in this country where there is overinvestment, so to speak, in medicine itself, that there are more procedures and interventions and medicines prescribed, and yet the health outcomes are worse than other countries that spend substantially less on medicine. You're also arguing that there's been a kind of systematic disinvestment over the last 40, 50 years in the social safety net. And so I wanted to ask you about, while these processes may have accelerated during that time, are the vested interests that support or profit from a private medical system part of this problem? And would you argue that one of the ways that the many problems that you're raising could be addressed could at least be started on by a system of socialized medicine?
I think the answer to the first question is yes. The answer to the second question is yes, although I would be careful about the phrase socialized medicine. There is no question that the transformation of American medicine into a system where there are deeply entrenched interests today in the system status quo, into becoming a sicker system because incentives are aligned, where the medical care system is paid essentially to treat sick people rather than to keep people healthy. That has become part of the problem, that it is very difficult to change systems when there are so many thousands and millions of people whose jobs are linked to the system being the way it is. So we need the imagination to change that. And there are efforts that are moving towards changing that. The CMS, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services Administrator, Chiquita Brooks-LaSure, has been very clear that she is pioneering efforts and pushing forward pilot programs within the Medicaid Medicare system that encourage systems to generate health rather than simply to look after sick people. Now it comes to them, what does one restructure into? Well, fundamentally, what you want to have is a system that is rational, that has a primary care provider that can look after everybody's health, that refers people to advanced care when you need it, but not otherwise create a patchwork quilt of incoherent providers that challenge everybody right now who intersects with the health system. What does our health system do and how is it structured? And it should be structured in a way where we all have providers who are responsible for us and who are responsible for us for our health and who work to make sure that we are healthy rather than to look after us only when we are sick.
Well, you're right that the medical profession has to change if these questions that you're raising about the state of public health or the health of the public in the U.S. are to be addressed. And I wanted to ask you about that. What sort of changes, starting with changes in orientation, would you think would be necessary?
I've come to think that most of the changes that are necessary start with the public conversation, with sitting around the proverbial kitchen table. And when you ask people what matters most to your health, that people shift away from saying, my doctors matter most to my health, the pills I take matter most to my health, to saying, what matters most to my health is the fact that I have a house that I can afford, that I have wages on which I can live, and the fact that I'm not worried about violence, random violence, when I walk out into the street. And we've done surveys of people, and most people still think that our health is driven by our doctors and our medicines. So I do think that the first step in that change is a shift in recognition. It's a shift in our conversation, a shift in understanding of what it is that generates health. And I suppose, to my mind, if we can bring about that shift, if that change can happen, politics will follow. Those who are in positions of authority, those who can make a difference in policymaking, will follow where the public conversation is at. And in no small part, that's why I wrote a book like this one. That's why we're having this conversation. It is an effort to nudge the conversation in the right direction.
And you're, of course, arguing that the kinds of changes that need to happen are systemic and structural, and so they're not limited to, say, the medical profession, although that might be part of it. So I wanted to ask you, how do you think, and in what ways do you think, those larger questions of how people live need to be altered? And obviously, that's not an easy problem to solve, since these are deeply embedded structures that have been operating as they have been for quite a long time.
I have fairly abundant confidence in the capacity of people to change and evolve in a way that is to get to a better place. We've seen it many times over history. And there are plenty of evidence that systems that in one way seemed entrenched in a particular way change in a way that we forget the way they ever were. Let's use one metaphor which I talk about in the book, which is firefighting. So firefighting has been with us for thousands of years. And the Roman Empire, which was building cities, and they realized that their wood buildings kept burning down, so they created fire departments. Now, fire departments operated roughly the same way for a couple of thousand years, which is they were sitting there and a fire was broke out, and then they ran to put it out, until about 50 years ago. About 50 years ago, an influential fire chief started saying, well, what if instead of just sitting around waiting for fires, we're also engaged in helping prevent fires to start? What if we started being involved in municipal inspections and setting fire codes and making sure that buildings have sprinklers? So that shifted. Fire departments started doing that. And today we have half as many fires as we had 50 years ago. Now, surely we all agree that that's a better world. It is a better world to have fewer fires. And fire departments are still with us because we still need fire departments in case there is a fire breaks out. But I would challenge us to say the fire departments operating the way they do today would have been unimaginable 60 years ago. Like, it's just not how we thought of things. I mean, think of other things that are unimaginable. You know, every day you get into your car and you tie yourself in with a seatbelt. Like, that's sort of, if you think about it, that's like an unnatural thing to do, right? And in fact, 60 years ago, that was totally unnatural. Let's take another example. 70 years ago, you and I would be having this conversation, Sasha, and both of us would be smoking. It was because everybody smoked all the time. Now we know, well, first of all, nobody smokes inside buildings, and the percent of people who smoke is 10 to 15%. Things that were normative, they were ubiquitous, they were just the way they were, they've changed. And now it takes time for things to change. It takes time, it takes decades, it takes centuries for things to change. And one has to recognize that if we're dealing with a structural problem, it takes a long time for it to change. And one has to be open to that. One has to recognize and have the humility to realize that it takes a long time for things to change. But they do change. I like to think, and I think history bears out, that they, over time, even though there are some steps backwards, they change for the better.
Do you anticipate that some of those changes might happen as a reaction to COVID? Thinking about the Spanish influenza, a number of countries in Europe following the Spanish influenza adopted a public health system of universal health care. Now, obviously, that didn't just appear automatically without people struggling for things. But do you think that from what you've seen so far that the pandemic has in some ways reinforced the biases of the past and hence chances are people continue along the same paths? Or do you see enough of a reaction to what's gone on during the pandemic that there might be a sense of demanding a different way?
Well, my short answer to that is I certainly hope so. And my longer answer perhaps is if we do not, emerging from this pandemic, ask for a better way now, I don't know when we will. Because we have had 700 plus thousand Americans' lives lost who wouldn't have died otherwise if it wasn't for COVID. We've seen this massive civil unrest that was, as we discussed earlier, catalyzed in no small part by the inequities we're seeing from COVID. This was a moment when we saw things that were there before, but before we were not seeing clearly. So this moment really should be a moment which pushes us to ask hard questions. And if you look at other large-scale transformational change, for example, look at climate change. Now, I'm not saying that we have arrived with action on climate change, but 20 years ago, climate change was not a movement to speak of. It was really not an important movement. I mean, when Vice President Al Gore was interested in this issue, you'll remember there was a sort of fair bit almost of derision of his interest in the issue of arguing with a fringe issue. Well, you talk to any Generation Z member today, and climate change is their number one priority on their mind. So these things do change, and of course they require relentless and clear-eyed push to say that we need to address this issue and make it better. And I'm arguing for the same thing for health, because at a simple fundamental level, it seems to me wrong that we spend more on health and live sicker and shorter lives. Just that makes me realize that we're doing something wrong.
Epidemiologist Sandro Galea is my guest. We're discussing the contagion next time. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, in terms of thinking about where to go from here and how to do so, one of the things that you write about in your book is a need for a different sort of outlook across the society, but especially from those in the medical profession. And I wanted to ask you about this question of cynicism in this country. There were many, of course, who said during COVID that we should just trust science, do what the scientists say, and that's the end of the story. And yet, obviously, there's been this deep well of mistrust amongst Americans. And, you know, some of that one can point to as the product of active misinformation campaigns on the internet. Some of it is mixed with religion. There's all sorts of different places where that mistrust seems to come out, but it was pretty roundly dismissed and has been roundly dismissed by quite a few people. And yet, wouldn't you say that there are people who don't trust science, don't trust the medical establishment, because they have operated in the system of all sorts of inequities, and that some people in this country feel like those are the perspectives of elites who are not in touch with them, putting aside the kind of right-wing populists who might play on it? Is there anything that we should recognize in that and take seriously?
Well, that's such a complicated question. There are easily 10 questions rolled into one there, which I appreciate. So let me try to pull it apart bit by bit. So number one, the mistrust of science, which I think has come as a bit of a shock to some scientists, but it should be a teachable moment for scientists. And the question becomes, why is science being mistrusted? And I would argue that in the context of health, science is being mistrusted because people believe their eyes and they notice that their health has not been getting better over the years. And as a result, why should they now all of a sudden trust scientists who say, this vaccine is the best thing ever, trust us? You know, if you ever have to say trust me to someone, you've of course lost already, because trust should be visible. And I think we have learned that there's a long way to go from the actions of science and medical science that are well-intentioned to people seeing them as such. So that's step one. Number two, I think we have conflated science with politics during this pandemic. The narrative that we should just trust science and do what science tells us is a naive narrative, right? Because science is often fuzzy. Science is often indeterminate. And fundamentally, the actions around COVID were actions around risk tolerance. There's no scientific answer about what risk we're willing to tolerate. It's a societal answer as to what risk we're willing to tolerate. It's a political answer risk we're willing to tolerate. I mean, just to use a concrete example, one of the clearest links between the decisions we make as a society and poor health, for example, is speed limits. If you drive at 45 miles an hour, a certain number of people die. If the speed limit is 55, more people die. If the speed limit is 65, more people die. So we set speed limits all the time. Now, why do we set a speed limit? Well, it says how long it takes us to get from place A to place B, right? But we are effectively making decisions on health based on how fast we want to get from place A to place B. Now, when I say that, I know it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable saying, what do you mean? Like, you know, we're making decisions on people dying. But we do that all the time. COVID was a prime example of that. And we got ourselves into this funny state of mind where we say, well, science has the answer. To which, as a scientist, I'm here to tell you, science didn't have the answer. Science had evidence, but that evidence needed to be weighed politically by what we're willing to tolerate. Now, unfortunately, and I'll go back to where you started the question, a lot of these discussions were shaded by enormous cynicism, because this pandemic hit at this very odd time, right? Where you had a president who was entering his fourth year, gearing up for an election, and very rapidly, everything about the pandemic became cynically manipulated by all sorts of interests on multiple sides. And everything was seen through the lens of how can it be used for particular partisan gain. And that, to my mind, removed our ability, very, very quickly, removed our ability to weigh different scientific perspectives, to weigh risks, the risks that we're willing to tolerate, to accept uncertainty, to accept changing our minds. Take masks. You may remember at the beginning of the pandemic, the CDC said you don't need masks. Then data emerged and the CDC said actually masks can help. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the science changing as we learn more. But that issue became just politicized. Like, it became, if you're blue, you wear a mask. If you're red, you don't wear a mask, which is silly, because if you're red or you're blue, the virus is not going to affect you differently. So we allowed science to become partisanized. And I do think it's partisanized rather than politicized, because I don't think that politics is necessarily a bad thing. So I think politics is our collective decision-making together. And ultimately, all of this required politics, required collective decision-making. But we allowed the science to be deployed in the service of very specific partisan ends, which of course benefited no one.
I wanted to ask you, looking forward, about how you think COVID may shape, number one, the emergence of new aspects of medicine, but simultaneously, do they carry the same perils of the present, in which medicine becomes the answer to all our health woes? I'm thinking here, there's a fair amount of discussion about how the new science of mRNA might lead to all sorts of vaccines for things like cancer and so on. And yet, if such a thing were to happen, and I don't know how you view that part. Are these in danger of being distributed unequally and having some of the same problems around them that you've flagged for the way our system works now?
Almost certainly. I think almost certainly that these technologies will end up being distributed unequally, which should push us into a reckoning with that and ask ourselves and push us to ask ourselves, what can we do to minimize that? There have always been inequities in the history of humankind. And in many respects, as long as we stick with market-driven economies, there will always be inequalities. The question is, how do we create the guardrails to make sure that the gaps between haves and have-nots and held haves and have-nots are not so wide? How do we create the social safety nets to make sure that the have-nots have enough to be able to lead lives with dignity and with good health? How do we make sure that we mitigate some of the consequences of otherwise untrammeled competitive systems that inevitably leave most people behind? So the question is not, will these result in inequalities? They almost certainly will. The question is, how do we keep those inequalities from becoming inequities that are intolerable to us?
Well, and before I ask you about future pandemics, I guess I'd like to ask you about the future of this current one around this question of vaccines and the rest of the world. You know, obviously, vaccines have been very contentious in the United States. Around the world, there are people who would very much like to be vaccinated, and yet the vaccines are not available. And I'd like to ask you how you understand the public health orientation, and I'm talking here the political decisions from the establishment, around vaccinating the rest of the world so as to prevent or not the possible emergence of new strains of COVID?
Well, if pandemic has taught us anything, it should certainly be that our health is not removed from the health of the rest of the world. It has been all too easy for us to say, let's worry about health in America, but let's not worry about health in Africa or health in Asia, because that's not really our problem. We may be charitable because we may be good people, but really, fundamentally, that's not our concern. Well, the pandemic has illustrated it is our concern, because if there is the pandemic raging in somewhere in Asia, all of a sudden a new variant could emerge which threatens our health and our life here in America. So this was an important moment to show that our health is interconnected, which then says it's the smart thing to do and the right thing to do to help ensure that the whole world is healthy. Now, vaccines is a good example of this, because the inequities in vaccine distribution, sub-Saharan Africa remains 2 to 5% vaccinated, should illustrate to us how far we are from having a world where accidents of birth do not just dictate our health throughout our life course. And we as a world should do better than that. It's the right thing to do, but it's also the rational and smart thing to do to protect our own health.
Well, looking forward toward pandemics in the future, you started this program by saying that although COVID has been terrible, it actually could have been worse had it been a different sort of virus. Obviously, you don't have a crystal ball, but as an epidemiologist, what threats do you anticipate may come toward us?
We've had pandemics all throughout human history. We have human history has been characterized by pandemics coming and going, being with us for a period of time, and then going away. And because of global climate change and urbanization, we are living in ever closer proximity to ecologic shifts that will result in other pathogens jumping species. So we will have more pandemics. The only question is, it's not if, but when. And not knowing when, it seems to me like our approach should be to prepare like one is going to be coming tomorrow, like we're going to have another pandemic in 2023, 2024, 2025, and certainly not wait until that pandemic hits. And as we're emerging from this one, one hopes by the grace of God we're emerging from the COVID pandemic, now is the time to pay attention to the problems that we have that make us so vulnerable to these pandemics, to the fact that we are a sicker, unhealthier country than we should be, that we are underinvesting in the forces that generate that health, and let's deal with those now before the next pandemic hits.
You just mentioned climate change, and I wondered if you could say something more about the way that tackling climate change could help with offsetting future pandemics?
So climate change is associated with large-scale, more disasters. That in and of itself is associated with poor mental health, is associated with changes in habitats and more infectious disease spread among the human species. It is associated with changing environmental conditions that result in more chronic disease. So climate change in and of itself makes us sicker as people. It also exposes us to greater risk of pathogens emerging in the human species that are not otherwise found among humans. So all of these things conspire to make us more vulnerable to disease and more likely to get novel diseases. So acting on global environmental climate change is indeed one necessary, not sufficient in of itself, but one necessary component of trying to reduce future pandemics.
Well, let me ask you as a final question to tell us, if you can boil it down, and I realize it's a tall order given the argument that you've made, what would you want to see done as soon as possible to try and prevent future pandemics, which, as you say, could come potentially another year within the next 5 years?
Well, if I were to wave a magic wand, I would say it's time for a new story of health. I think we have had an overwhelming investment in doctors and medicine and in biotech solutions, which has yielded great fruit as evidenced by the pandemic. But a consequence of that has been we have come to see health as a private commodity, something we can buy and sell. But that's inaccurate, that health is really the state of not being sick to begin with. And we need to create a health system that rests on the preventive conditions of health, on forces like safe housing, good schools, livable wages, clean air, drinkable water, fair economy. These are the conditions that are inextricable from having a healthy world. And I want us to redraw, rewrite the story of health so that we can all understand that.
Dr. Galea, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sandro Galea is Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. He's the author of The Contagion Next Time, published by Oxford University Press, as well as the book Well. You can find a link to The Contagion Next Time at againstthegrain.org. And you've been listening, of course, to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.